Good afternoon and welcome to Spokane Public Radio's Northwest Arts Review, a half hour exploring the people, places, and events forming the rich arts tapestry we enjoy here in the Inland Northwest and our wider Intermountain Northwest region. I'm Jim Tevenin, pleased to be your guide on this journey. This week, Chris Massini introduces us to Carter Hudson, another NPR Tiny Desk Contest entrant from the Inland Northwest. Also, we meet the Bozeman Symphony Orchestra music director-elect Norman Wynn, and hear a Dan Webster movie review. The Bozeman Symphony, led by then-conductor candidate Norman Wynn, takes us in with a bit of Gioachino Rossini's music in Ottorino Respighi's arrangement for his ballet, La Boutique Fantasque. This is Northwest Arts Review.
The Tiny Desk Concert has become a mainstay of internet music. Intimate concerts from well-known and obscure musicians performing at Bob Boylan's desk at NPR headquarters. And for the past several years, NPR has opened up the Tiny Desk Contest, asking musicians from around the country to submit videos performing at their own tiny desks. This year, one of those entrants was Carter Hudson, and he joins me now to talk about his submission. Carter, thanks for talking with me.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so tell me, how'd you first hear about Tiny Desk and the contest, and why'd you decide to submit this year?
Well, I heard about Tiny Desk, gosh, probably back in high school or something, just from watching different musicians on YouTube. And I didn't know about the contest until, I don't know, maybe back in February or something. A friend of mine had mentioned that they were having one. And then I think I saw it on Instagram or something like that.
And so the song you entered is called I Can't Hear You Anymore. What can you tell us about this particular song?
Yeah, so it's a song I recorded and released as a single at the end of February this year. It's a song that means a lot to me. It's about my grandmother. She died when I was 10, and it was that fall of 2018 that I realized I couldn't hear my grandma. I call her Nama. Couldn't hear her in my memory anymore. I could still see her, but for whatever reason, she came up in my memory, and I was grieving her at that time and just missing her. And then it was quite poignant as I realized, like, shoot, I don't remember what she sounds like. And it just, I think grief is this weird process that, at least for me, is certainly not linear. It ebbs and flows, and I don't know. Yeah, so it's a song sort of dedicated to her, about her.
Yeah. Well, let's listen to a bit of it.
Great.
So this is I Can't Hear You Anymore by Carter Hudson. Was an excerpt from I Can't Hear You Anymore by Carter Hudson, his submission to this year's Tiny Desk Contest. So Carter, we heard a little snippet of that song, and one of my favorite things about the Tiny Desk Contest is you also get to see everybody's like home sort of recording and desk area, sort of like the fun of seeing the tiny desk. And you're sort of in this, you're surrounded by guitars and musical equipment. I love it. So
thanks.
Tell us about your space and recording this song for the contest.
So my friend Klaus is the one who shot the footage for me, and we had talked about kind of where we wanted to do it. We were thinking about maybe going, I don't know, to a spot like above the river for a scenic view, something that was kind of iconic Spokane, maybe going downtown. And then eventually just settled on, like, well, why don't we just do it in my room? Because that's where I make most of my music when I'm not performing. I like having my guitars out of their cases, just like putting, so I hang them on the walls or put them on, on stands. Because I like to have them out, and that often sort of inspires me to play more and write more and just like have them around. So yeah, it's a fun space, and I write at that desk often. It's actually my great grandpa's desk. So it's a super old desk. I think it's like oak or something. But just my room.
I also couldn't help but notice your 805 area code. So what brought you to Spokane, and how have you found the local music scene here?
Well, I love Spokane. I've been here for 6-ish years. Moved up here in 2014. I went to Whitworth. Nice. So I studied music there and theology. Had a great experience. Loved it. And then I've been out of college now for a couple of years. And I really like the music scene here. I think over the last 10 or so months, I've tried to immerse myself more in the scene. It is, like, I guess, fairly small when you compare it to a city like Seattle or Portland or something, somewhere else in the Northwest. But it stands true in its own right. I think there's a lot of really talented musicians and just high quality people. And it's fun. I think I enjoy the fact that us musicians know each other. We respect each other. We like to play together. So I'll often sit in with other groups or have them come sit in with me. It kind of has that, it feels very Spokane in that it's not trying to be anything other than what it is, you know?
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. Yeah. And so, I mean, the last couple months have obviously been a really strange time for everyone, but I think for musicians and performers in particularly who are used to, like you said, sitting in with each other and jamming and, you know, performing in front of groups of people. So have you found ways to continue making music and performing?
Yeah, that's a good question. I would say, I don't know, 3-ish months ago. It's hard to measure time for me right now.
Yeah, totally.
I feel like I heard a musician I like, he referenced measuring time in emotions. Like, he's like, yeah, that was about 10,000 emotions ago. Like, in this whole time of life. It's just a weird time. So I did Instagram Live for a little bit every week. I typically play Thursday nights at a bar called The Drinkery on Garland. I do the booking for them as well. So I decided, like, well, why not just try to reach an audience via social media and do the live kind of streaming thing. And that was good. I did that for, I don't know, maybe 6-7 weeks. But it's a weird space. I imagine other performers would relate, and you don't see your audience. And so that to me is, I don't know, it's just really hard to connect. And it's, So I stepped back from that and just have, really not performed in quite a while.
Yeah, totally.
I eagerly await trying to play shows again, even though I just think it's going to be a weird sort of transition into that and what that looks like.
Well, Carter, we look forward to hearing and seeing you perform in the future sometime when we can get back. In the meantime, is there a place where folks can, other than the Tiny Desk video, can find some of your music?
Yeah, if you look me up on Instagram, Carter S. Hudson, you can see videos that I post on there of me playing, working on stuff. And then if you go to Spotify or Apple Music or any other streaming service and just type in Carter Hudson, my single, which I submitted for the Tiny Desk contest, is on there. So those would be great places to check out.
Great.
And then once I am doing music again, you can come see me at The Drinkery on Garland Avenue or down at Zola.
Yeah. Well, Carter Hudson's submission to this year's NPR Tiny Desk contest is I Can't Hear You Anymore, which you can find on YouTube, and we'll have a link at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Carter, thanks for chatting with me.
Thanks so much, Chris.
7,500 is a thrilling ride, says Dan Webster in his movie review.
Flying is kind of far from my mind these days, though I can't blame that feeling totally on the COVID-19 pandemic. Even before it was deemed to be unhealthy, even foolhardy, to fly in an airplane with passengers, some of whom are unmasked and sitting in some cases as close as a foot away, and all of you breathing the same recycled air, the likelihood of long lines, cramped seats, bad food, and delayed flights were a regular part of the airline experience. So imagine my surprise when, while watching the movie 7500, I was reminded of what used to be considered the biggest threat to air travel. And no, I'm not talking about the computer problems involving the infamous Boeing 737 MAX or mysterious disappearances such as that of the still unfound Malaysia Airlines Flight 370. I'm talking about the threat of terrorist hijackings. 7500, which was written and directed by German-born filmmaker Patrick Wohlrath, is a taut 93-minute-long thriller that is set almost entirely, save for a brief prologue and the film's final few seconds, in the cockpit of an Airbus A319. Taking his film's title from the code used to denote a hijacking, Wohlrath introduces us to Tobias Ellis, played by Joseph Gordon-Levitt, an American first officer working on a night flight from Berlin to Paris. Sitting aside the flight's captain, Michael Lutzman, played by Carlo Kitzlinger, a real-life former pilot, Tobias goes through all the mundane, if important, pre-flight protocols that give 7500 its sense of authenticity. Everything changes, though, when minutes into the flight, three men charge the cockpit door and one manages to attack and stab Michael. In the melee, Tobias, too, is wounded, though he manages to subdue one attacker and shut the door on the others. Then he's left to deal with one unconscious hijacker, a desperately injured captain, a bleeding arm, and a plane heading toward the ground, while the other hijackers pound on the door and demand to be let in, or they'll kill the passengers and flight attendants. In this situation, Wohlrath is posing the question, what would we do? And that query becomes especially urgent when the hijackers begin making good on their threats, and as we learned early on, Tobias has a particularly intimate relationship with one of the other crew members. 7500 is writer-director Wohlrath's first feature film, following a succession of shorts that includes his 2015 Oscar-nominated live-action short, Everything Will Be Okay. That German-language film, too, has a claustrophobic feel as it involves a divorced father who kidnaps his young daughter and ends up holding her in a hotel room, and has some of the most intense closing minutes of any film I've ever seen. Still, little is more claustrophobic than the cockpit of Wohlrath's Airbus, which gradually becomes littered with bodies, only some of which are still breathing. Added to that, Tobias' situation becomes increasingly desperate as he tries to fly the plane, tend to his own wounds, physical and emotional, and talk to those on the ground who direct him to make an emergency landing, all while that incessant pounding continues. Gordon-Levitt is one of those one-time child actors. He's likely best known for the sitcom Third Rock from the Sun, whose career was made over through his performances in such neo-noirs as 2005's Brick and 2007's The Lookout. Those films led to roles in much bigger movies such as Christopher Nolan's 2010 thriller Inception and producing and even directing credits such as 2013's Don John. He's the perfect casting choice here, believable both in his quiet moments as a professional aviator and then as a harried character facing the difficult consequences of a proverbial Hobson's choice. If there is a criticism to be made of 7500, it comes mainly from the film's avoidance of larger issues. Yes, the terrorist intentions of the would-be hijackers are philosophically based, yet they serve mostly as the MacGuffin that Wohlrath uses to fuel the film's pulse-pounding action, and about as significant as the corpses that are left strewn on the jetliner's entryway. Still, if you're looking for an intense hour and a half, 7500 might be what you want. If nothing else, you won't be required to wear a mask, or made fun of if you choose to don one anyway. For Spokane Public Radio, I'm Dan Webster.
Movies 101 host Dan Webster writes about movies and more for Spokane7.com. Movies 101 airs at 6:30 Friday evenings on KPBX and Saturday afternoons at 1 on KSFC. You can find podcasts of Dan's reviews, Movies 101 shows, and previous sessions of Northwest Arts Review at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Orderly processes in all corners of society were early casualties of the COVID-19 pandemic, and the painstaking process of choosing a music director for a regional orchestra is definitely not immune. Faced with an interruption in director auditions, the Bozeman Symphony Orchestra elected to select a new conductor from those who had already led the orchestra in performance. Their choice? A first-generation Asian-American musician, associate conductor of the Oregon Symphony, and Portland resident Norman Nguyen. I talked with Norman and orchestra executive director Emily Paris Martin about the selection process and what is ahead for both the director designate and the orchestra in these difficult times.
In your choosing Norman for the job, what were the most significant factors or qualities that led you to say yes to him?
Norman just really excelled through the interview process. There were four pretty significant stages: the initial screening, the video submissions to evaluate his conducting style, his time in Bozeman, and also just maintaining some communication with us throughout the process. And we're watching his conducting videos. You know, I'll share with you that one of the committee members specifically said he is going to be a star. And when he was in Bozeman, he just very naturally and quickly connected with everyone here. It really just felt like he was a local, and that was certainly what we were looking for. Someone who was incredibly talented on the podium, worked well with the musicians, and was perceived well by the audience. Mm-hmm. And he just really established himself as a local, and we had a lot of people reaching out specifically about Norman.
Let me shift the focus then to Norman for a second. How satisfied were you when you finished your time in Bozeman, when you finished your audition? Did you have a feeling that you had nailed it?
After that week, hopping on the plane into Bozeman and flying back to Portland, I sort of was just reflecting in the airport and thought that it was a really successful 10 days. I met so many people who are extremely supportive of the orchestra. The orchestra themselves, the musicians, were sort of like got on board very quickly with what I was trying to do with the music and my interpretation and bringing it to life. And everyone was just very highly engaged in all aspects around the organization. And the performances were very electrifying. The audience, both concerts were completely sold out. It was just a wonderful way and festive way to end the 2019 year. I had a really great time, and I felt that I had represented myself well.
What is it you're most looking forward to in terms of getting in and rolling up your sleeves and working with the orchestra?
Yeah, really this whole first year is going to be us diving deeper into the music and sort of figuring out where both of our expectations lie with each other. And I'm just looking forward to getting to work and sort of honing the sound and trying to figure out where our strengths and weaknesses are as an orchestra and really just go on and develop a sort of identity, both on stage and for the community of Bozeman.
Are there any things that are projects of yours or things that you like to do with orchestras that you would like to initiate with the Bozeman Orchestra?
I think for me, what's really nice about the orchestra as a medium, sort of as a vehicle of music, is that it can act sort of as an avenue for many different musical genres to come together. So one thing that I would really like to do is to broaden the genre of music that we play. Currently, we do six classical concerts, and it's strictly classical music. Mm-hmm. And I want to expand that. What sort of indie artists are there that people relate to, and make the Bozeman Symphony a place where every single one of our offerings can be is diverse and casts a wide net, and be creative in how we use the orchestra, whether that is also through a film setting or a rock band or a tribute band to someone like Andrew Bird, who has a very symphonic kind of sound to his writing. And I know he has a show with orchestra. So those kinds of things I'd like to look forward to and expand. And also, I'd like the Bozeman Symphony to have this identity in not only in Montana, but nationally as a place that's really creating new music and music that is relevant. So bringing composers in to spend time in Montana and to feel what these people hold so special in their lives and to write about that musically and share that through the orchestra.
That's an excellent idea. The realities of the situation right now are such that you can't just call a rehearsal next week and have everybody show up and away we go. So I'm wondering what kinds of planning you've done together on this and where you might be able to start things off and at what level you might be able to start things.
It is incredibly challenging because you're navigating so many different dynamics. And for us, really wanting to focus in on our musicians and what are they comfortable with? Are they comfortable gathering together as an ensemble? Is it the full group? Is it something modified? Are they comfortable performing in front of an audience? And what is going to be possible? We don't own or operate our own concert hall, and we rely on our community partners for aspects of our rehearsals and our performances. So there's a lot of hurdles that we're going to have to jump through and get creative and innovative and really wanting to rely on the input from our staff, from our board, our orchestra committee, our community, our patrons, to really push the Bozeman Symphony forward. And I think one thing that is really great from all of this is there's been so many projects or passions that we have here at the Bozeman Symphony that we've been wanting to move forward with. And this has kind of just pushed us to go in that direction. And I'll let Norman speak to more of the specifics, but he's really been such an asset already in the few weeks that he's been with us to provide the artistic vision and the leadership that we need in this type of planning.
Emily sort of mentioned this already with the rehearsal space and concert performance space and looking at what we can put on stage safely for our musicians. So right now, it could realistically be 8 to 15 musicians. It's possible if we have a bigger venue, a 30 member size classical sized orchestra. I mean, if we find a really big place, an arena, we could spread out and have a full orchestra and do a Tchaikovsky symphony. Right now, it's a lot of, you know, honestly, it's just a lot of thinking. There's and thinking through different scenarios and finding and starting to discover repertoire that's more than just the typical Soldier's Tale, Appalachian Spring for 13 instrument, you know, musicians. Mm-hmm. What else is out there? There are Beethoven arrangements of some of his own operas, you know, those for smaller ensembles. So there are a hundred of pieces out there. And now it's, okay, if that's going to be the case, what does a program look like? There's also another opportunity where if we can't come together or can't have an audience, that doesn't mean we can't get together internally with our own musicians and be able to hopefully capture and tell the stories of the people that sit in the Bozeman Symphony and play the music. And how can we present that in a digital format through a video or documentary style, or do a performance without an audience, but capture in a very beautifully visual way, an audio way, and maybe have a watch party with our subscribers and have some of us on there live answering questions while the show is, or the concert is going on or something like that. So there are many different avenues and paths that we can take. And I think it's all about deciding and just being creative and knowing what we actually can control, because there's a lot of things that we can't.
Oh, absolutely. It'll be interesting to see, because the whole distancing thing is not going to go away anytime soon. In terms of the musicians, and I guess a really good question right now without an answer is, what does that sort of distancing do to a sense of ensemble? Because you're mentioning an arena stage with a Tchaikovsky-sized orchestra where the closest person to you is almost 2 yards away. Now, how does that all sort of come together at the next level up? Which I guess is going to remain a question until we actually do it.
And there are orchestras in Europe the European orchestras are starting to gather right now. There are a lot of pictures, and the Concerto Bell conducting masterclass is actually going on now. I don't know as we speak, but they're up there with playing Brahms and big pieces. So I think it's possible, and good thing there's a conductor there to visually give give visual cues for everyone to stay together. But you're right. If the places that we're thinking about, they can do that because they have large concert halls and a big stage. That's something that we just don't have right now in Bozeman. And if we're in a place like an arena, you know, acoustics is a big factor. And so we'll just have to think creatively and try to figure something out.
As you gather, and let's say that you are able to gather as a reasonable size ensemble and not just as less than chamber orchestra size, what would you like the first piece that the full orchestra gets to play be?
Well, I guess I wasn't...
I mean, this doesn't necessarily have to be the for performance, not the first piece that an audience would hear necessarily, but is there a piece that you think that the orchestra, for which it'd be especially meaningful for the orchestra to play the first time they're back together again?
This doesn't include the full orchestra, but a piece of music that I've been very interested in performing recently and have been listening to a lot is George Walker's Lyric for Strings. It's a piece of music that he dedicated, or he wrote for his grandmother who passed away while he was a student at the Curtis Institute of Music. And it's about 6 minutes long. It's so beautiful and cathartic and healing. And I think it's a piece right now that, you know, when we all come together, it will have a very special meaning for us. You know, there are many different ways we can go out, especially with when we come together for the first time. But I think, you know, something flashy and loud doesn't feel right. Something, you know, like Tchaikovsky's Pathetique doesn't also feel right. It's too sad. So this one, I think, is the George Walker's Lyric for String is very uplifting. And there's room for reflection. And it's just a beautiful piece of music.
Yeah, and George Walker, of course, is a composer, frankly, neglected. Yep. So to have something performed by him is a good thing. Also, it's appropriate music for the time that we're living in. It's Norman Wynn and Emily Paris Martin, thank you so much for being with me today and telling us a little bit about how this great ship is about to relaunch, we hope, with the Bozeman Orchestra, with Norman Wynn at the wheel, as it were.
We will continue to follow the progress of the Bozeman Symphony and other cultural organizations as they work to stay healthy and relevant in the midst of significant challenges. That's part of our mission here at Northwest Arts Review. You can offer your observations and suggestions through kpbx at kpbx.org or by calling our listener comment line, 509-232-6904. I'm Jim Tevenin, and it's my pleasure to produce this program with help today from Chris Messini, and thanks to Dan Webster, Carter Hudson, Emily Paris Martin, Norman Wynn, and the Bozeman Symphony Orchestra, who take us out with a bit more of La Boutique Fantasque. Join us again next week for another Northwest Arts Review.